Have a listen, short and concise.
Joining us tonight in the 500 Section Lounge, Richie Little Matt. We have retired colonel in the U.S. Air Force and author of Right to Influence, Carla Bass. Carla, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, it's our pleasure. First off, I want to start, and I know we all here feel similarly, but thank you so much for all of your service throughout your career. It's a great thing that you do, and to be selfless and sacrifice those things to protect everybody else. So thank you very much.
You're most welcome. It was an honor.
Go ahead. So what was it about the air? I have a lot of questions just about the Air Force and things like that. What was it about the Air Force that pulled you into it that made you want to choose that branch?
So easy. I was in seventh grade. So how old are you when you're in seventh grade? When I decided not only Air Force, but Air Force intelligence in particular.
Wow.
And what drove that was, and to date myself a little bit, that was when we were still in the midst of the Vietnam War. My father was a colonel in the Air Force. At that point in time, he was a target intelligence officer working ungodly hours in the Pentagon. And he also did two annual stints in Vietnam. But my mother would almost daily point her finger at me and say, Carla, don't ask your father anything about what he does because he can't tell you. And she told me that once too often. And I decided, well, shoot, if he can't tell me, I'll just join Air Force intelligence myself and I'll find out what it does. And so that was it. It was my curiosity. And I grew up in a very patriotic family, you know, love of America, love of mm-hmm. country. And so it was a calling. And I was called in seventh grade and I never varied from that path.
That is awesome. I love hearing that. Grew up in an American patriotic family. That to me is so special.
When it came to, was your mom then supportive of that decision? Like, you were adamant that you were doing it from the seventh grade on. Were your parents, and I know your dad was involved in the military, was your mom okay with that, or did it take some influencing?
No, fully supportive. My mother was that quintessential Air Force wife. They were married for 50 years, but 30 of those years, she was the Air Force wife. And my father was gone. They tabulated it once. He was gone for a total of 7 years of their marriage. And so was a single parent during all those years. Yeah. Doing the wallpapering and plumbing and cooking and taking care of the kids when they were 6-7 years is a long time to do that. But no, she was just as patriotic as well, we were all equally. Her father emigrated from Norway. And so she too was raised in a country, in a family that just adored this country. And so she was completely supportive of that decision.
Awesome.
So Air Force intelligence, what kind of grades did you get go? And did you go right out of high school then? And how did you decide to get into that? I know you wanted to answer, be with your dad, but how hard was it for you to get into that
spot? It was easy. I did not come out of college. I mean, I went to ROTC, I went to Purdue and went through the Reserve Officers Training Program there. I did the 2-year program. When you sign up for the 2-year program, they ask, what specialty would you like? I said, intelligence. They said, what flavor? I said, what do you mean, what flavor? Well, there were all different kinds of intelligence, but I didn't know that because nobody could tell me. So I closed my eyes and picked one. And I actually called my dad and I said, okay, Dad, there's all these different flavors. I don't know what they mean. Which one should I take? His response was, do you like to travel? I said, yes. He said, do such and such. And I did. And 30 years went by in just a heartbeat.
What are some of the locations that you got to travel to?
I started off in Germany. I did a 6-month deployment to Turkey. I was the defense attaché for 3 years in Bulgaria. Many years in Omaha, Nebraska. That doesn't sound so sexy, but it was with the Strategic Air Command, and I learned so much during those 7 years. I was a squadron commander in Hawaii for 2 years, and that's actually what started the journey of Right to Influence.
Wow. Go ahead, Matt. I know I've been hogging it. Sorry, buddy.
Oh, no, I just letting you ride here. Now, you said that started the Right of Influence, or what exactly started that? What kicked all that off?
Well, it goes back to my dad. My father commissioned me from ROTC there at Purdue. And when he did so, he gave me three pieces of advice that I pass on to this very day. One was stay focused on the job. Don't get caught up in office politics. Two was keep your sense of humor. That is so important.
Yeah. But
three, and what drove me to this day is take care of your people and they will take care of you. So how that all came about and what brings me to talking to you today is when I was a lieutenant colonel in Hawaii, I was a squadron commander responsible for 480 super talented young men and women. When I arrived at that unit, it was the most losing in statewide quarterly and annual professional awards. But the tragedy was it wasn't losing because these weren't good people. They weren't doing great work. They were losing because their bosses couldn't write winning packages. So you could be the smartest tech sergeant or the most talented Air Force captain, but if your boss can't tell your story, you lose. So yeah. That I took 3 days vacation. I sequestered myself in a beach cabin and I analyzed my writing. And out of that came this little tiny handbook. And I turned that into a 1 hour workshop. I taught my guys to write and we started sweeping the awards. We went from the most losing unit to the one to beat. And then everybody else asked if I could teach them too. So I ended up teaching my 1 hour class for the next 15 years. To thousands of Air Force people, wherever my assignments took me, this word sculpting thing came along with. I had no idea how vacuous the need was out there, and it still is, for learning how to make every single word count. That it's a skill that's not taught in schools anymore, and so I'm pretty passionate about sharing what I can do with others.
When you were teaching, did you leave like one or two steps out so they weren't as good as you so you could still win?
You know, those other units on Hawaii, when they said, hey, can you teach us too? My first thought, which happily I kept to myself, was, and pardon my French, but well, shit, there goes my competitive edge. But I taught them and it was the right thing to do.
Right. So I teach and I've taught English in the past and I'm the same way. They kids don't write the same way. Like I had submissions that were text talk. So like for the word great, I would get G-R-8. I'm like, no, no. But I always would, I had a little sign that was above me when I was at my podium at the front of the room that said, I'm silently correcting your grammar, because I would try to be as diplomatic as possible to say, hey, you know, let's change the way we're saying that. So that, because you know what, if you write the way you talk and you don't talk very well, mm-hmm. it's gonna, like you said, if you can't, you're not taking advantage of every word you're writing down.
In my book, I have a list of what I call the dirty dozen, the 12 mm-hmm. most common errors made in professional communication, professional meaning coming out of college, or and it could be someone who's new to the workforce or someone who's mid-level or senior career in the workforce. And one of those 12 is don't write as you speak. People will mistakenly submit that first draft as the final product. And mm-hmm. and they don't purge it from all of the colloquialisms or it's far more than just proofreading. But yeah, don't write as you speak is a biggie. Example of that is, I'm going to get you up to speed on the new policy. Well, get you up to speed doesn't cut it. I'm going to inform you. I'm going to update you, but get up to speed on. People just don't know how to polish and how to write refined when the product calls for that.
I have another question, and it's grammatical. I've always gone personally on when to use I or me is you take the other person. If it's two people, take the one person out. So like Matt and I are going to the store. It would be, I am, but if I took Matt out of there, I am going to the store. So it sounds correct. Is that a tried and true thing? To where it sounds, because I've heard on like news stories and stuff, somebody would say so-and-so and I, and it just didn't feel like it felt right. Am I wrong? I know I'm not, you're not coming on to tell me about grammar, but I've wanted to talk to somebody about this that might have some understanding of when is it right to use so-and-so and I.
Okay. And I, yeah, I've got the answer to that. Unfortunately, English is devolving, but you say you and I, when you and I are the subject, you and I are going to speak, you and I are going for a walk, you and I are going to sit down and play cards. You use you and me when those two items are an indirect or a direct object.
Okay.
They threw a party for you and me. They threw a party for me. They threw a party for you and me.
And see, that's what I was getting at, is I hear a lot of those to where they say you and I at the end of the sentence, and it just doesn't sound right. So are they screwing up?
They are.
Okay. Thank goodness. It's not me.
That's why I say our language is devolving, because somewhere along the line, people stopped teaching the teachers, and the teachers don't teach the students. Mm-hmm. And that's why when people, even coming out of grad school, even though you may have had the AP classes, the A plus all the way through school, people are coming out writing fat, not writing skinny. And the employers out there are looking so desperately for people who can write with focused precision, because they need to communicate their business objectives. They need to sell somebody through a briefing. And if you can't leverage that time and space, and remind me to talk to you about the white rectangle, but if you can't leverage that time and space, then game over. And this simply isn't taught in schools anymore.
I actually had a political science professor when I went back to get my, my undergrad. He had four or five writing assignments a semester, and he said, they don't go over 2 pages. He says, as soon as you hit 2 pages, if you've got more, I stop reading. He said, the president of the United States only takes a 1-page single-spaced memo, and then he stops reading. So like he was basically saying, if it's good for the president, I'm going to treat you the same way. 2 pages double spaced, so it equals 1 page single. And he said, once you hit that 2 pages, I'm done reading. He said, you need to go in and take it out and make it less than 2.
Well, and that's exactly it. So one of my first assignments I think I was a first lieutenant then, was giving the daily briefing to the director of the National Security Agency.
Yeah.
All right. So I learned from the earliest days that every second of the audience's time counts. Mm-hmm. And so for 50 years, I've written for Congress and the White House and generals and ambassadors. And that's what I convey in my book, Right to Influence, how you get that compelling message across as briefly and concisely as possible, so that it's received and you can elicit the reaction from the audience that you want.
Does it feel pressure, like knowing that you're writing it for some of these big, huge decision makers? Does it feel like, you know, oh my gosh, if I screw this up, you know, it's trouble. Like there's no pressure because you're that confident in the way you write.
Correct. Okay. No pressure.
Gotcha. Sorry.
Who are some of your favorite people to work with? As you mentioned, some of those, the bigger titles.
My two mentors, and these are just amazing gentlemen. And I use that word in every sense that it connotes, are General Hayden and General Clapper.
What was it about them that made you, you know, I mean, they're your mentors, but
their intellect, their patience, their care for their people, their ability to assimilate information, their wisdom. I think that pretty much covers the waterfront right there.
Yeah. That's, I like that. I like that. Got more?
What was it like to, I'm sorry, what? You said, of course I did. Well, I will change what I was going to ask. Did you have were some things you enjoyed reading, or reading other people's writings as you were going through this phase, not a phase, but this part of your life.
So my favorite genre, and I guess I inherited this from my dad also, was the spy thriller. That's if when I do have free time, which isn't very often, that's where I always gravitate. Alistair MacLean was one of the first authors, and now that's turned to Daniel Silva and Dean Koontz. And if I want to go off on more of a fantasy thing, Diana Gabaldon. You know, people often say the more you read, the better you write. Well, I'm quick to amend that, because it depends on what you read.
Yeah, that's very true.
So much, pardon my French, crappy writing out there. If you read that and that's all you assimilate, you're going to write like that too. So I emphasize Dean Koontz, Daniel Silva, and Diana Gabaldon, because those three authors can cram more sense, more meaning into one simple sentence. I mean, I hang on every syllable that these authors convey. The one example from, it was Daniel Silva, the doorbell rang with the sound of an angry infant. I mean, just think about that.
Wow.
Okay, and that's just one example. One of the workshops that I teach, it's about writing fiction, because, you know, everything I write now, it's usually in the context of resumes or grants or, you know, business writing, but nobody likes to read fat, fluffy fiction either. So right. Spin that captivating tale is what I call the workshop, where I apply my writing methodology to fiction. Because you need to keep the entertainment. You need to keep the reader on the hook and wanting to get to that next paragraph, whether it's fact or fiction.
Where did you study the correct, or who did you learn the correct way to, like, write with influence? Like, was that something that you developed on your own, or did you study a lot of people who you read and then went boom?
During those 3 days in that beach cabin, I walked the dog backwards, and I credit my seventh grade English teacher, Mrs. Barbara Gelwicks.
Okay.
When I was a major, this is the assignment right before Hawaii. When I was a major, I was a division chief in the Pentagon. That was the first time in years that I actually was responsible for a group of 30 people. And so, again, thinking back to my father's advice about take care of your people, I was submitting all of my folks for professional awards, and they kept winning. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. I just wrote, and they won. When I finally recognized that it was my ability to write, to tell their stories, that was advancing their careers, and I attributed it to Mrs. Gelwicks, when I returned to D.C., I found her. She had just had a really bad heart attack or stroke, but she was at home, or her husband let me come visit. So I brought with me a picture of me when I was in seventh grade, so I could show her, so she could help remember. But I told Mrs. Gelwicks that she's the one that got the credit for advancing these other people's careers. I was just the instrument. If she hadn't taught me how to write, if she hadn't instilled in me the love of grammar, this wouldn't have happened. So you, Mrs. Gelwicks, you're the one that are making the difference in these people's lives. And I was so grateful that I had the opportunity to close that circle and convey that to her.
Well, that, and you made the connection to it too. Yeah. You know, like, you didn't know that it was her until you started winning these awards. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is has to be from her. And the more you looked at it, there it was.
Yep.
Well, and just, I would have never thought about this, that someone who is presenting me could be the reason that's holding me back. I mean, that's something I never would have.
Yeah. Unintentionally too.
Yeah.
Well, and exactly. Along those same lines, something else I tell people, because they just don't think about it. If you are a stellar performer, and if your boss recognizes that, there's absolutely nothing wrong with you approaching your boss and say, there is this organizational award that's approaching. Would you mind? Could I please draft a submission on myself? And would you be willing to sign that? People just don't think about that.
Right.
So I gave that same advice. A woman hired me for a private counseling appointment. And I told her that same thing. Her resume, which I helped her rewrite, but she was such an incredible woman with so many wonderful accomplishments that weren't being told. So I received an email from her last week, as a matter of fact, that says, thank you for the advice. I did what you suggested. My boss submitted the nomination that I wrote. And you know what? I made Supervisor of the Year.
Awesome.
All right. So it's okay to take care of yourself. You know, your boss should be doing that, but the bosses are busy. So you're right. Helping the boss fulfill his or her responsibilities if you have that working relationship.
Yeah, they sometimes, excuse me again, like you said, they should be doing those things as a supervisor, but sometimes, you know, things get away to where they don't have the time to do it.
Yep.
So if you can do it, then poo.
I think they'll be more than happy to sign something that's well written and hand it to them, as opposed to taking the time to
write it out themselves.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
You wanted us not to forget the white rectangle. I wanted to make sure I did not forget that.
That's what I was just looking at it, so I didn't shake it out of my head here.
Okay, thank you. So the premise of my writing methodology is this. Every writer, whether you're a fact or fiction, whether you're writing a blog or a budget justification for Congress, every author is constrained by two things. You're constrained by time, tick, tick, I'm busy, we're all busy. You're also constrained by space. Space is that white rectangle. So it could be a demarcated area on a government form. It could be summarize your grant submission in 250 words. It could be give me input to your performance appraisal in 1,000 characters, including spaces. So the moral is the author who can control time and space the best wins. Now, in that white rectangle, put one word in there in big fat block letters. It's called opportunity. So the more precise you're able to write those, the more of the, and this gets into the word sculpting, which we need to talk about at some point or other, but the more powerfully you write, the better you leverage that space, and that's how you get opportunity.
Well, I was going to say, let's just go right into word sculpting here, because I'm one of those, I'm a flowery typer. And like when I'm writing a normal like email, it's just, you know, quick and to the point, but I have to go through like four passes to get it from a paragraph down to like two sentences. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, just on emails. And that's, you know, I guess the difference between the important ones and the ones I'm just firing away saying, yep.
Matt, I'm the same way. I often, you guys know, you know, audibly I ramble, and I tend to do the same thing when I write, but in a different way. Like I don't write as I speak, but I ramble still.
Okay. So word sculpting. I'm going to back the conversation up just a bit. Think in terms or envision an inverted triangle. Okay. And this is how I present the book, and this is how I teach my workshops. The first thing you need to do from that macro perspective at the top of the inverted triangle is you have to strategize your message. That's a whole separate conversation. But when you get down to the bottom part of the triangle, you now have your draft. All right. You've sculpted, strategized the message, and now you've got the draft. This is where you apply word sculpting tools. Now, word sculpting. So poof, you are a sculptor. You're in that sun-drenched studio in Paris. You have your hammer and chisel. And because you're a master sculptor, you know the image that lies dormant in that marble. So chisel, 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 there's a rubble, there's your statue. Word sculpting is the same thing, except instead of the marble, you've got your draft. So I have 10 word sculpting tools. Sentence by sentence in that draft, you apply these word sculpting tools, and by time you're done, you've gone from 10 pages, and you're now down to 5 hard-hitting solid pages. Now, an example of one of the word sculpting tools, it's number 5, I think. I call it verbs are your friends, rely on them. And to explain this one, imagine a hard-boiled egg. Got it?
Yep.
Now make the hard-boiled egg 6 foot tall, big hard-boiled egg, and focus on the yolk. The yolk is the verb. The white is all that bureaucratic blather that we smother verbs in nowadays. So I'm going to read some of these. So for example, provide a description is describe. Work collaboratively is collaborate. Place an emphasis on is emphasize. Keep to a minimum is minimize. Okay, so sentence by sentence, look at the verbs that you use and cull out all that white stuff and focus on the yolk and go for the hard-hitting verb itself. The same thing occurs, word sculpting tool number two is called don't use words that hog space. Now, there are several categories of that. The one I'm going to share now is condense several words into one. So, for example, on a daily basis, which you hear that everywhere, it's ubiquitous. On a daily basis is simply daily. On a monthly basis is simply monthly. Equal and capability is on par with. In an expeditious manner is expeditiously. Up to date is current. On at least one occasion is at least once. So you see how you go from using several words down to one or two.
So those added words don't necessarily make you sound smarter. They just take space up.
Yeah. And remembering my white rectangle with opportunity, the more slovenly you write, the more opportunity you cost yourself.
Yeah.
Wow. I really love hearing, you know, people, you are so passionate about this. We can tell, listen to you. So thank you for sharing. Because we talk to a lot of different people and they're all passionate in their own thing. And I've never been able to have a conversation with somebody that is as passionate as you are about this topic, which is very impressive.
What I learned, the one life lesson, it changed my life. That Hawaii assignment, it was a 90-degree pivot for me that's still continuing. The lesson that I learned in that, and that's why I am so passionate, is that powerful writing changes lives. Yeah. End of conversation. You could be the most talented individual, the most perfect fit for a job opportunity, but if you can't reflect that in your resume, you're out. Not only do you lose, but the employer loses also because he hires the wrong person. So powerful writing, it changes lives. It's the lifeblood for effective business. It opens doors to opportunity that otherwise simply wouldn't be there. I got an email not so long ago from an individual. It said, Colonel Bass, you may not remember me, but I was a senior airman in the 324th Intelligence Squadron. I kept that handbook for 18 years. I was able to be accepted into officers training school, which is a big deal, very competitive. I just retired after 20 years as an officer, and I'm now a vice president of a defense corporation because you taught me to write.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Now, if that doesn't give goosebumps, nothing will. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm so passionate. I have so many stories that come back to me like that. I'll keep driving. I did another podcast a couple of weeks ago, and the concluding question was, Carl, if you had 1 week left on this earth, what would you do with it? My answer was visceral. I would double down. I would work even harder than what I can now to share this message with people because it empowers them to change their own lives.
That's fantastic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You are listening to the 500 Section Lounge, hosted on Spreaker.
From earaches to strep tests, there's MinuteClinic at CVS. See a provider, fill a prescription, and grab essentials. Or see us online with telehealth options. That's healthier made easier. Visit MinuteClinic at CVS today. Services vary by location. See MinuteClinic.com for details.
Hey, this is Russ.
This is Kyle.
This is Michelle.
From the Infectious Groove Podcast.
Join us every Monday for the most fun you can have with a music podcast. The Infectious Groove Podcast uses a positive and fun approach as we take time every week to share our jammy jams, then dig into a thought-provoking topic discussing all decades and genres of music. You can find the Infectious Groove Podcast on all major podcast platforms, or you can head to infectiousgroovepodcast.com to find us there and subscribe. We might have a controversial opinion here or there, but we always have fun with it.
Oh, I'm sure I'll say something dumb.
Subscribe to the Infectious Groove Podcast, part of the Odd Pods Media Network.
From earaches to strep tests, there's MinuteClinic at CVS. See a provider, fill a prescription, and grab essentials. Or see us online with telehealth options. That's healthier made easier. Visit MinuteClinic at CVS today. Services vary by location. See MinuteClinic.com for details.
When you got into the military, how hard or difficult, what kind of obstacles did you have to face being a female in the position that you got into?
Oh, Oh, that is such an insightful question. I entered in 1977. So I was on, you know, you take away all the heroes from World War II and so forth, but but I was the leading edge and one of those groundbreakers, the glass ceiling and all that. So remember that I had waited for this since seventh grade. Okay, seventh grade. My first assignment, my first boss, I walk in, I'm so enthusiastic. I shake his hand. And this Lieutenant Colonel says to Second Lieutenant Bass, we didn't want you here. We fought having you come because you're a second lieutenant, but they said if we didn't take you, we wouldn't get anybody. I thought, okay.
And thank then you.
His boss, who is the colonel, he said, why don't you just go home and have a family?
Wow.
All right. So that was the environment. That's the bad side of the coin. The flip side of the coin is that one of the many reasons I love the Air Force is it promoted people based on their performance, based on their potential. So you give me, even with that kind of old thinking mentality, they still put me on the same playing field with everybody else. So you give me the same challenge as all the guys, and I'm going to knock it out of the ballpark. And they recognized the people who performed well, and they promoted accordingly. So it was a bit of a bucket of cold water, that initial assignment.
Yeah, but sure.
I soon proved myself and came out with meritorious service medal as a second lieutenant, which was unheard of, still maybe unheard of.
Did you have, or did any of those superiors like change their tune at all? Or was it for basically the whole time you dealt with them, it was, they didn't want you there and you could tell?
No. They recognized, you know, okay, once they got over the shock of having a female second lieutenant, right, they got over it because, okay, I hit the ground and I did things that simply hadn't been done before.
Okay.
And so, you know, they recognized that and they backed off.
Gotcha.
When you were over, I believe you said you were in Bulgaria. Is that right?
Yes.
What was the daily life like your daily routine? And did you interact with, you know, Bulgarians, or was it just on the base? What was that like?
No, I lived on the economy in a house that the State Department provided, but it was in the Bulgarian neighborhood. I interfaced daily with the, you know, well, let me explain to your listeners what that meant to be the attaché. I was America's senior military person in country, representing our military to all of the Bulgarian military. Okay. And so I spoke Bulgarian in those days. And not only was it myself representing myself, not myself, representing America to our Bulgarian counterparts, I was also interfacing daily with the attachés from all the other countries who are accredited to Bulgaria. And what was every day was different. It was literally a 24-hour a day job. You were always on. I loved it.
I was going to say, was that ever a burden, or was it like, yeah, keep giving me more?
No, it was never a burden. Awesome. My husband had a role, even the children, you know, part of the life of an attaché is hosting functions there in the home. And so my children were in sixth and eighth grade at that point, and they had a role. They would collect the flowers. You know, it's a big deal bringing flowers when you go to someone's home. Right. They would collect the coats and hang the coats. They were diplomatic kids. When we left country, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, well, their equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, threw a major diplomatic function for the attachés who were departing. The one thing I wanted to convey my thanks to all of the Bulgarian military. So our children were with us at this event, and I knew that they had memorized the Bulgarian national anthem. So impromptu, impromptu, there were two microphones there. So I asked General Kolev, who is the senior military man in all of the country, if my children could perform for this group of 75 or 80 people. And Sarah and Eric, they sang the Bulgarian national anthem. And it was such a shock. And it was so appreciated because the Bulgarians love their country very much also. So to see these two American kids singing a national anthem in a language that's not their own and doing it beautifully, was just a wonderful way to say thank you and to recognize, to express America's recognition and appreciation for our Bulgarian ally.
Well, I just, you said something about, you spoke Bulgarian back then. How much do you think you could take if, you know, you went back over there just to, I mean, could you get by, or is it just kind of fail there after a while?
I love languages. And so I walked that dog back to Mrs. Gelwick's, but German, French, Spanish, Latin, Bulgarian, Russian, and Turkish are the languages that I've studied. And I say studied, they kind of go, German always stays with me. The others will go to sleep, but with a little bit of advanced studying, I refresh them and they awaken. And so the answer is I could speak it again with a little bit of refreshment, and I have all of my books.
I can barely speak English.
I'm still learning that one. Yeah,
I can remember La Cerveza Por Favor in Spanish, and that's about it. And that's the only other language I've.
Okay, I can order beer. If that's all it takes, bathroom. I can add Norwegian to my list. Ja vil ha en øl is Norwegian for "I'd like a beer, please."
I've tried learning other. We've had foreign exchange students, the couple that are Italian that my wife and I are going to hopefully in the next few years be able to go visit while over in Italy. And I've tried learning Italian, and it's very similar from what my kids from Italy have said. It's very similar to Spanish, but there are differences. So it's one of those that, you know, I can't just try to pull off of my knowledge from Spanish. I would be lost in Italy right now.
I think I'm lucky to be here where we are right now. I'm still doing all right. I moved up from Texas, you know, when I was in high school, and I took 4 years of Spanish, and I don't remember hardly any Spanish now because I just don't use it. You know, when you don't use it, it's going to end up being gone, I guess.
I think that's what Carla's saying. It might take some refresher to get it back up.
It just goes dormant.
Yeah.
But it's there.
So what's next for you? Like, are you maintaining your events? Are you doing consultations and stuff? Are you still planning on doing that for a while? I mean, what's next?
So I've during the COVID days, I had many, many in-person presentations that were unfortunately canceled. That's the bad news. Good news is it old dog, new tricks. I'm now really good at giving live webinars. So I give webinars. I just came back from an in-person event in Orlando. Oh, this was so exciting. I gave a presentation on how to write winning grants to the annual convention of the National Service Dogs for Veterans.
Oh, beautiful.
There were about 150 people there representing 30 nonprofit organizations. And what was amazing is many of these individuals, well, they're all out there acquiring funds, training the dogs, matching the dogs with the veterans, and then training the dog and the veteran to work as a pair. But many of these individuals are themselves fighting their own challenges, and they had their own service dogs that would enable them to attend this conference. So giving that presentation in person, explaining to them, here's how you write that compelling grant to get the money so you can continue providing the service, that was an honor also. I'm also developing several web-based training courses. You know, I've got one, it's almost done. It's called Catapult Your Career, Right to Influence. And so it addresses everything from the resumes to the cover letter to the interview to the post-interview thank you note. Here's how you write input to your performance report. It takes you through the whole cycle of employment. And then I wrap it up with tips on how to get promoted based on my 30 years in the Air Force and the Dirty Dozen. It's a 3.5-hour course. I go to Pennsylvania probably next month and record it. I'm really, really excited about this. So if I ever get hit by a truck, everything that's in my head
will be available. Well, I wonder how I get what grade I get from Carla, because normally and normally what I do is my post interview thank you is normally when we publish, but that's sometime a couple of weeks away from the time we talked. Is that too long of a gap? Should I be sending a thank you prior to the publishing of the show?
No, not at all. The thank you note is, this is specifically in the context of the interview. And in that instance, mm-hmm. you need to turn that like within a day.
Uh-huh.
The old cliche about strike while the iron's hot. Well,
right.
definitely with the thank you note. You know, you're saying thank you to me. I'm the one that's saying thank you to you. Thank you to you. So you don't need to thank me, but if I were applying to you for a job and you and I just interviewed, you better bet that the next thing I'm going to do is send you that thank you note, an email, but a thank you note.
Well, I can tell you that my wife is very, very good at that. She's taught the boys to, you know, anytime you get a gift or anything, you write a thank you card. Even if it's just a couple of sentences, there's some appreciation there. But she is always like, she'll ask me, okay, they're making a decision within the next couple of days. She just accepted a new position and she had a second interview. And she said, is it okay to send an email since they're making a quick turnaround on their decision? And I said, I would think it would be at least better than not getting anything by the time they make the decision. You know, was I incorrect in that suggestion? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand. I would have tackled it differently. Now, depending on how quick she's discussing, what I advise on thank you notes, where the thank you note actually is influential in the mm-hmm. resulting decision, I would not send an email, because an email is just that. It's another email that
right.
may or may not reach the person, may or may not be read. And so you've just lost an opportunity. So I advise people to write a thank you letter. A letter as opposed to a note. A note is little tiny, little
right.
space. And remember my white rectangle opportunity. So if you write a letter, that gives you more opportunity to make your space. You personalize it by handwriting a note in one of the margins. I really enjoyed our conversation. I really want to work for your company. Just that little handwritten note. But then you email them. You say, I have just mailed you a letter. Please look at it. So you cover the email for the timeliness. You've got the letter for the formality and the polish. And you've got the little handwritten note that personalizes it.
That's beautiful. That's a great way to at least let them know. I know we just bought a house and my wife wrote a letter just to explain what it would mean for us to get the house. And I don't know for sure, but it seems to me that there was a little bit of influence in that for them to accept our offer.
Exactly. You know, it's a personal connection.
Sure.
It shows a little bit about you, that you are a decent human being, that you care, and that you're reaching out to somebody. And that you know, the whole name of many of these games is to stand out from the crowd
right.
in a good way.
Right.
And so that's what we're talking about, is that put you above those competing buyers or competing purchasers who didn't write that kind of a letter. All right. You get yourself an edge that way.
I would say,
and they see that you appreciate how they took care of their house, and a lot of people take pride in that as well.
They're invested in that home too, and so they want to convey it to someone who's going to share that concern and appreciate mm-hmm. what they've done for it.
You started talking about, you know, you want to stand out. I have a cousin who she is a chocolatier or chocolate business, or she makes chocolates in Nashville.
And they're fantastic.
Delicious,
they are,
by the way.
Awesome. That's not the point of the story, but she went to college in Nashville, and she, when she was growing up until she was 20 years old, I think, was part of a circus. And it was a non-animal circus. So they did the high wire. They did, you know, the acrobats and stuff like that. And she was part of that. And she said she got her internship, her college year, or is her freshman year, because she put that into her resume or her application.
Yep.
And it made the people reading the applications to say, I want to know more about that. It's not necessarily she's in on it, but, or, you know, she's got it, but I want to learn more about this person that put that on there.
Stand out from the crowd. So when I wrote the first book in 2017, many of the local public libraries came, and I love public libraries, but they said, Carla, can you do a workshop on the essays for college applications? Can you do one on grants? Can you do one on all these different topics? Well, I didn't have those in my hip pocket, so I developed them. And after teaching these various workshops, I turned all of those, the material I developed for those workshops, into the second edition of the book. And mm-hmm. so the second edition of Right to Influence has 70 more pages than
the
first edition. And one of those chapters is on here's how you write the essay for college applications. And it's exactly that. Find something that speaks to you personally, that sets you apart from the crowd. Don't write about big ticket items like world peace, because they want to know about you. Who are you? What makes you tick? And so that is, that's a great example of how exactly to do it.
We had another guest also, Mark Hirschberg, who said that that he was a bartender in his, because they were all applying for the same job mm-hmm. and they all had relatively the same credentials.
Yep.
So when it comes to that, he was a bartender, and it brought up a question just to, you know, kind of break the ice type thing. And that allowed him to show his personality as well.
Yep. So these examples, going back to my inverted triangle,
yeah.
These are how you strategize your message, how you don't bury the golden nugget, how you get the most important information up first, how it is that you can make yourself stand out from the crowd. So the whole first part of the book, the first part talks about various ways to strategize your message, and that's exactly it.
You said tell it right away, so you're not wanting us to write a mystery, right? You know, to where surprise at the end, that's all right, the answer.
There are some times where you purposely bury that golden nugget. I'm gonna mention that in my spin that captivating tale story. There are some times when you don't lead with your opening punch.
Right. Well, you know, I like to keep it suspenseful.
Go ahead. Oh, I've only got that. I have that one. I
didn't see it.
Oh, hold never on. Mind. Sorry.
That's all right. Matt, are you hearing me?
Yeah, I'm hearing you.
Okay. Yeah. Just sometimes we have issues with audio.
No, I'm not going so anywhere. Much worried. I'm having Whew. Too much fun.
I was trying to figure out what you guys were talking about there.
Oh, he said he sent me a question, but I haven't looked at my messages. So
What do you like to do? What's a daily routine? Where are you based out of? Where are you living right now, Carla?
I live about 50 miles west of Washington, D.C., out towards Shenandoah. Oh. I still work for the government. I love what I'm doing. So I commute every day. I'm up at 3 in the morning.
Jeez.
Oh, my.
On the road at 4 in the morning. I'm at my desk at 5 in the morning. And I still work for the government. So I'm still writing those strategies that go to Congress and the mm-hmm. White House. And I'm still out there defending democracy and supporting our nation.
Wow.
Is awesome. The getting up at 3 intentional, or is it just you've been so programmed that, you know, you get up early, get ready, leave by a certain time, that regimen?
It's both. My body clock for me getting up at 3 in the morning is normal. That's no problem. But it's also because of the commute. If I have to be, because I live so far away from where I work, I have to get ahead of the traffic bow wave. So leaving it at 4 in the morning enables me to do that. Okay, if I left any later, I wouldn't be able to, keep this job. I simply couldn't do it.
You'd be stuck in a heartbeat, huh?
Yeah. I've been working and getting up at 7 enough. I just do it on the weekends now. And I set my work alarm to get up for golf this morning. And I'm just like, yeah, that's
about right.
I don't sleep in anymore.
The other thing I do when I'm not working and not giving webinars, I have a newsletter that I send out twice monthly. I used to do it monthly, and someone mm-hmm. got on my case and said, do it weekly. Well, I'm sorry, I can't do it weekly, but I can do it twice monthly.
I'll meet you in the middle. How about that?
Exactly. But I call it, it's Right to Influence Quick Tips. So it has an anchor article, always, you know, valuable writing tips, and then just kind of catching my readership up on other upcoming events. Carla at righttoinfluence.net. If anybody is interested in getting that, that's how you can obtain it. And the other thing that I did when this COVID mess first hit and people were so set back with the economy and so forth. I wrote 3 free ebooks.
I'm looking at those right now.
The first one is called Right to Win a Grant Submission. The second is Right to Win a Standout Resume. And the third is Right to Win Input to Your Performance Report. I figured those were the 3 functional areas that people needed the most help with. And so those 3 free ebooks, they take all of my writing strategies and the word sculpting tools and laser focus on those 3 products. And that was my way of trying to help people. So between the newsletter and those 3 free ebooks, again, that's how I'm trying to, as another friend says, make the world a better place.
Do you follow any sports? Do you like, you know, anything? Is it not enough time to even worry about it? Sports, I'm just asking.
No, don't like sports. Southern living, I love baking and I love cooking. So Southern living, I'm a big Southern living fan. I used to collect antique playing marbles.
Sweet. That's pretty cool.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting.
What else?
And I read in here, Cocker Spaniel named Cash.
Oh, Cash went to dog heaven.
I'm sorry for bringing that up.
No, that's okay. That's where you learn to focus on the positive. We had him for 8 incredible years that seemed like 8 days. So I'm very grateful for the time that we had Cash.
I had a dog similar to that was around before my wife and even my oldest son. And I had him for probably 14 years. And it was just like when he was gone, it didn't seem like I'd hardly had him. Yeah. But yet I had all those memories of him. Quincy was a good boy. I loved Quincy.
Yeah, you just have to learn how to look on the positive. He was born with a defective liver. And so, I mean, Cockers usually last 15, 16 years. Right. You only had him for half. And so instead of bemoaning that, it's, you know, you give thanks for every day that you had him.
Well, and that was Basset Hounds. I'm a Basset Hound guy. They only live anywhere from 9 to 12 is the extremely old, and Quincy lasted to 16. So like as soon as he hit 9, I was like trying to soak up all of it because he was just a crazy dog. He had such personality. You know, it was just great. Now with my current Basset Hounds, I see, and I had one named Wrigley that was pals with Quincy. I see their traits in the 2 dogs that I have now, which are also Basset Hounds. And I just love them. I love them. Big floppy ears, short little legs.
Oh, they bring a smile.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Quincy or Clark will look at me and just give me a look that I'm like, oh, I can't be mad at you.
You mentioned your 2 kids singing the national anthem in another language. Did they follow your footsteps and go into the armed services also?
Nope. My daughter, like the Air Force was a calling for me, indisputable, irrefragable. I love that word. she was called to be a mother. So Sarah lives out in California. She's 30 and she has 7 children.
Wow.
And I call a spade a spade. She is an amazing mother. I go out there every time there's a new baby and they come out here not as frequently as they used to because it's kind of hard traveling with 7 kids.
Right.
But she, you know, there's a commercial now, I think it's Kraft, with the mother chasing the kid down the hallway because the kid's not going to eat
the broccoli.
I hate that commercial. Sarah figured out a while ago that if the child isn't going to eat dinner and pulls that kind of an attitude, she'll say, fine, go to bed, and she'll serve that very same plate for breakfast the next morning. I so disagree with the philosophy in those commercials.
You can eat it now, you can eat it later, but well, the next meal you have is this.
A wrong message. But she's a wonderful, wonderful mother raising 7 well-behaved children, respective of each other. So that's her niche. And our son graduated college. He's working in a defense industry corporation here in the DC area. So 2 children of whom I'm adults. Okay. But I'm very proud of them.
Right. Donnie Moore.
It's like we got the full perspective. I love it.
I think we did. Matt, you got any more?
No, I think that's about all I can offer.
Matt, you got anything you want to draw on? What's your favorite color?
Purple.
Oh, I can't argue with purple. Okay, mine's orange.
Orange is my second. It seriously is.
Hey, there we go.
Did you, when my you were out?
My favorite color is purple. Favorite musician, I've got two of them. Barry Manilow. I've taken 40 years of grief for being a Barry Manilow fanatic, but that builds character into my dying day. Manilow rocks. And Robert Goulet. He was such an amazing performer.
I have a buddy that I used to work with. I worked in a bank 10, 12 years ago, and there was a buddy who was a personal banker. And that was right around the time the Will Ferrell skit of him playing Robert Goulet came out. Mm-hmm. And he always, he decided to have a staring contest. And he's like, staring contest. Up, you win, you always do. And that's what I love about Robert Goulet is the Will Ferrell. I like his music too. Don't get me wrong. I always remember that Will Ferrell skit. I'm a Billy Joel fan.
Oh, he's good too.
I have seen Billy Joel the last two times that he was at Wrigley. I saw him at Madison Square Garden 2 years ago. I was supposed to see him last summer and this summer. Well, the last summer, yeah, at Notre Dame Stadium. That obviously got moved. I was supposed to see him this summer at Notre Dame Stadium. Well, it got moved to next year at this time. So I'm not very happy that I had to break my Billy streak.
One other thing I'd like to drop in the conversation is so much of this is focused on my dad in the Air Force. I wanted to give a nod to my mother because the foundations that a parent parents provide for the children are hugely instrumental on what direction they're going to go. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned that my mother's father immigrated from Norway. So she had a very strict upbringing. I'm the oldest. I had that same strict Norwegian upbringing too. But mom was she grew up in Southside Chicago, super poor. Okay. So she completely self-made. She was a couturier dress designer. She was a radio show host. She had a couple of newspaper columns. She was a twice published author of two books, and she was an amazing artist, not to mention the time she spent as the Air Force wife. So, you know, mom also, and her advice to me the same time dad was giving me his three pieces, the whole time I was growing up, she like a drumbeat, it was, there's no such word as can't. No such word as can't. Set your goals high and go get them. And whenever I said I can't, oh my God, she didn't smack me, but I heard about it. So those are good words also. Set your goal. And I try to share this with young people. Set your goals high. And as long as you instill in yourself, there's no such word as can't. You know, you don't hold yourself back. Just be hungry and go get it.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. That message, because it's absolutely true. It kind of goes with my memory of Ford. What was his name? Henry Ford. Jeez, oh, Pete. He had the statement of whether you can or whether you think you can or you can't, you're right. You know, if you put that can't in there, well, yeah, you've already said you're defeated. So I kind of liken that to what your mom said. It's absolutely, you know, set your goals high, go get them, and don't say the word can't.
Yeah, she would not let me say can't. There's no such word.
I love it.
I love that too.
That's love great. It.
Yep. Get your mindset love going.
It. Yep. Carla DeBass, this has been such a treat. It has been such a good time. I love talking. I got a little geeky when it came to the grammar and asking that. I understand that, but it's bothered me for a while because I'll hear, you know, I hear those newscasters end a sentence the wrong way. And I'm like, oh, it's like, it's that proverbial nails on a chalkboard. Mm-hmm. And it drives me batty.
Oh, yep. I completely agree. And I actually, it's refreshing for me to find someone else who is simpatico.
Yes. It immediately makes me think or give them a little bit less credit. or credibility when I'm listening to them, because I'm like, come on, that's an obvious, that doesn't even sound right. Can you, you know, it just, I don't know. Yeah. Drives me nuts. Drives me batty.
I'm big on there.
On there?
There. Yeah. That's, I'm big on that. When I see them in emails, work emails, I'm just like, just.
Oh,
just,
when they type it out?
Just take a second.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not incorrect because it's a right word. It's the right spelling. But come on. Think about it.
A little professionalism. Just a little professionalism.
Yeah. Take a little bit. A couple of seconds to proofread it, just to reread it for what it is and do a little bit of work on it, you know, make it sound a little bit better. You know, don't make yourself feel silly. It's kind of like a couple of those posts on Facebook or social media or whatever. It says, you know, somebody's criticizing somebody else's grammar and they have a grammatical error. Yep. And it's like, so oh, you just lost all credibility because you didn't even follow your own advice.
Yeah, the people that live in the glass houses, right?
Yeah. You know what? They're quick to throw stones. And then when you show them that they're, they're incorrect, then they all get all mad and everything.
So if your listening audience or viewing audience needs any help, everything I do, everything I provide is on www.righttoinfluence.net. I webinars on all sorts of different subjects. They can hire me by the hour for that private coaching, which is what that one woman did.
Yeah.
And, you know, on her, she hired me for an hour, but honest to goodness, I think I spent 8 or 10 hours working on a resume. But, you know, I care about this stuff and I couldn't accomplish what I wanted to accomplish for her in 1 hour. So, you know, I charged her that rate and then invested so much more time in it and look at the results. So that's the win behind the sales.
Yeah. And you like you mentioned, righttoinfluence.net, at the very top, it says free newsletter sign up. Click on that, put your information in there, and you'll get the twice monthly newsletter that Carla sends out that she compromised with an emailer. Instead of doing it every week, she'll do it every other week. So you can go there. You can also find her book on the website. You can go to it has links for Amazon, Barnes and Noble, IndieBound, any of those ways that you want to get the book. Carla, this is fantastic. You're in the United States Air Force for 30 years. You got to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel.
Full Colonel.
Okay. Full Colonel retired. You're still doing the work for the government. Thank you for your service. Thank you for what you do now. Thank you for trying to help people become better writers, because you know what? You're going to see a lot more success if you're a better writer and you know how to use those words the right way. So
thank you so much.
Oh, well, this has been so much fun.
And yeah, it's been great. Thanks, Carla.
Yeah, it's been an absolute treat. And Carla, we really appreciate it. And we'd like to maybe bring you back on and talk some more. I don't know that we hit everything.
Anytime.
All right. Thanks so much, Carla.
Okay.
Thank you.
Retired Air Force Colonel Carla D. Bass, writer, author of Right to Influence.